Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, brought to you from our offices overlooking San Francisco's historic Market Street. I am Jim Copeland, Senior Director of the Club. We also welcome the listeners of KMTT, The Mountain, in Seattle, Washington, one of more than 200 radio stations nationwide carrying America's longest-running radio program. We invite all our listeners to visit the club on our website at commonwealthclub.org. And now for today's program. The Commonwealth Club is once again pleased to present a major author in the continuing series Good Lit, featuring host Barbara Lane, Book Awards Director for the Club. Barbara's guest this afternoon is author Nick Hornby. Here to introduce Mr. Hornby and his work is Barbara Lane.
Thank you, Jim. Nick Hornby's memoir about his lifelong obsession with soccer, Fever Pitch, launched his reputation as a master of the male confessional. 3 years later, he came out with High Fidelity, a novel about a commitment-phobic pop music junkie. It was a laugh-out-loud, read-funny-passages-to-your-friends kind of book and became a hit picture starring John Cusack. And then came About a Boy, a novel about a guy who lives off royalties from an insipid Christmas jingle written by his late father and who pretends to be a single dad to meet vulnerable women. Nick Hornby, who also writes about pop music for The New Yorker, is here today with his new novel, How to Be Good. Nick Hornby, welcome to Good Lit. Glad to have you. So let's start talking about the new novel first, and the inevitable question, of course, why you decided to write this book after all these male-type books from the female point of view.
Because when I thought of the story, it seemed like it needed to be told from the female point of view. The idea I conceived was that I wanted to write about a marriage that was under strain, and I wanted one of the partners in the marriage to undergo a fairly dramatic spiritual conversion, and the other one to comment on this conversion. And the more I thought about it, the more it seemed to me that it would be the guy who would go from being disappointed and bilious and angry and bitter and cynical to kind of intemperately embracing this rather bizarre new vision that comes to him after he's been healed. And so, you know, that left me with Katie to narrate. I have to say, this is not a novel about what it's like to be a woman. That would be presumptuous of me, I think.
You think? Well, let's have a reading from the novel for those who haven't read it yet, How to Be Good. And why don't you set it up for us before you launch in?
I guess what you need to know is that Katie is a doctor and has always been the moral conscience of her family and her relationship. And at the beginning of the book, she's having an affair, her own sort of complex moral calculations. She reckons she's entitled to this affair. And then when her husband is healed after going to see a healer for a bad back, he comes back wanting to change the world and wants his marriage to work, and she suddenly feels that she's on the moral back foot, having been on the moral front foot all this time. The part I'm going to read, David, the husband's just given some of their dinner away to the homeless. None of us feel like eating that night, not that there's much to eat anyway. I'd planned to microwave the frozen lasagna, but there's none left. It's already been driven to Finsbury Park, where it was served up in paper plates to the winos who hang out on benches just inside the gates on Seven Sisters Road. David dished it out on his own while the rest of us sat in the car. My daughter Molly wanted to go with him, but I wouldn't let her. Not, if I'm honest, because I thought she was in any danger, but because she's nauseating enough at the moment, as it is. I was worried that if I had to watch her feeding the poor like an 8-year-old Dickensian charity lady, I would begin to hate her too much to provide proper maternal care. When we get back home, I excuse myself and go and lie down in the bedroom with the Sunday papers, but I can't read them. The stories no longer refer to me, 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 but to David and the sorts of things he would do something about. After a little while, I find that I'm beginning to see news stories not in terms of information, but in terms of potential trouble for my family and for the contents of my bank account and freezer. One article about a group of Afghan refugees holed up in a church in Bethnal Green, I actually tear out and throw away because it contains enough misery and hardship to starve us all. I look at the gaping hole in the newspaper and suddenly feel very tired. We cannot live like this. Not true, of course, because we can, comfortably. Less comfortably than before, maybe, but comfortably nevertheless. We will not starve, no matter how much lasagna is given away. Okay, then. So, we can, but I don't want to. This is not the life I chose for myself. Except that's not true either, because I did choose, I suppose, when I said that I would marry David for richer, for poorer, in sickness and in health, as long as we both shall live. This, obviously, is relevant, because he may well be sick, and poverty may well be approaching fast. What did I think I was choosing when I married David? What do any of us think we're choosing? If I try to recapture now the semi-formed fantasies I had then, I'd say they erred on the side of prosperity and health, rather than anything very difficult. I thought, I suppose, that we would be poor but happy to begin with, meaning that we would be living in a small, cute flat and spending a lot of time watching TV or drinking halves of beer in pubs and making do with our parents' hand-me-down furniture. In other words, the difficulties I was prepared to tolerate in the early years of my marriage were essentially romantic in their nature, inspired by the clichés of young married life as depicted in TV comedies, or possibly, given that most TV comedies are more sophisticated and complex than my fantasies, by building society advertisements. Then, later on, I thought, one set of difficulties, the difficulties posed by watching TV in a small flat and by eating baked beans on toast, would be replaced by another, the difficulties that arose when you had two lovely, bright and healthy children. There would be muddy football boots and teenage daughters hogging the phone and husbands who had to be torn from the TV to do the washing up. Golly gosh, there'd be no end to those sorts of problems. And I was under no illusions. Muddy football boots would be awfully trying. I was prepared, though. I wasn't green. I wasn't born yesterday. There was no way I was going to buy white rugs. What you don't ever catch a glimpse of on your wedding day, because how could you, is that some days you will hate your spouse, that you will look at him and regret ever exchanging a word with him, let alone a ring and bodily fluids. Nor is it possible to foresee the desperation and depression, the sense that your life is over, the occasional urge to hit your whining children, even though hitting them is something you knew for a fact you would never ever do. And of course, you don't think about having affairs, and when you get to that stage in life, and when you get to the stage in life when you do, and everyone gets there sooner or later, you don't think of the sick feeling you get in your stomach when you're conducting them, their inherent unhappiness. And nor do you think about your husband waking up in the morning and being someone you don't recognize. If anyone thought about any of these things, then no one would ever get married. Of course they wouldn't. In fact, the impulse to marry would come from the same place as the impulse to drink a bottle of bleach. And those are the kinds of impulses we try to ignore rather than celebrate. So we can't afford to think about these things because getting married or finding a partner whom we will want to spend our lives with and have children by is on our agenda. It's something we know we will do one day. And if you take that away from us, then we are left with promotions at work and the possibility of a winning lottery ticket. And it's not enough. So we kid ourselves that it's possible to enter these partnerships and be faced only with the problems of mud removal. And then we become unhappy and take Prozac, and then we get divorced and die alone. Perhaps I'm getting things out of proportion. Maybe all this contemplation of bleach drinking and Prozac munching and solitary deaths is an inappropriate response to the crime of giving lasagna away to starving drunks. On our wedding day, the vicar asked us, in that bit where he talks to the bride and groom privately, to respect one another's thoughts, ideas and suggestions. At the time, this seemed an unexceptionable request, easily granted. David, for example, suggests going to a restaurant, and I say, okay then. Or he has an idea for my birthday present, that sort of thing. Now I realise that there are all sorts of suggestions a husband might make to a wife, and not all of them are worthy of respect. He might suggest that we eat something awful, like sheep's brains, or form a neo-Nazi party. The same must apply to thoughts and ideas, surely.
Thank you. Nick Hornby, reading from How to Be Good. Now, far be it from me to be presumptuous here, but Are we making fun of liberals a little bit?
Well, I'm a liberal, unrepentantly so. But I do often wonder and fear what would happen if I were ever confronted by any of my liberal beliefs by somebody who actually wanted to put them into practice. So I guess the book comes out of that to some extent, yeah.
Well, it does deal with this thorny question that's stated in the title. How can we be good? How can we be good if we're stepping over homeless people on our way to expensive restaurants? And how can we be good in light of the world around us today? And that is a tough one.
Yeah, and I think probably the answer is that we can't be. We can't be as good as we would want to. So the question then becomes, how do we cope with our own badness?
Or, as takes place in this book, David, at least, after undergoing his spiritual conversion, and one thing you didn't mention was David's job before his big change, is he is the angriest man in Holloway, the district in which he lives, in which you live. He writes a column with that title, and it's his job to spew bile in the newspaper, worse and worse every day. In fact, what has he taken a stand against at the beginning of the book?
Old people who travel on buses.
Nice guy. Anyway, What he finally comes down to is maybe we can't change the world, but we can have some effect on what you call life in your postal district. So we're really talking about individual responsibility, aren't we?
Yeah, I think that is what the book's about, and it comes as something of a shock to Katie, who feels that she has taken enough individual responsibility with her job. I mean, it's her mantra all the way through the book. I'm a good person, I'm a good person, I'm a doctor. That suddenly she doesn't feel good enough and that she hasn't taken enough responsibility. And it's that shortfall in which the narrative of the book takes place, really.
Well, things do go a bit awry when everybody in the neighborhood invites a homeless person to live in their home. It gets a little funky there.
Well, this is David's big plan, and again, to a certain extent, a lot of the questions that David poses are unanswerable. If you have a big house and there is a spare bedroom in it and there's someone sleeping rough outside on the pavement, shouldn't you be offering the spare bedroom to the person sleeping rough on the pavement? And Katie doesn't really know what to say to that, but David goes on a campaign for the street to take one in, and with semi-disastrous consequences.
Well, there's also a sense of be careful what you wish for, because here's Katie at the beginning of the book thinking about leaving her marriage because David is so angry and so awful and so bitter, and then, in fact, her wildest dream does come true. David undergoes this conversion. He goes over the edge, really, and she can't deal with that either.
No, all the things that she would have wished for, as you say, be careful what you wish for. He is very loving and patient, but very focused on the world outside the home. And this completely confuses her because I think she's got used to David's cynicism, and she says, at one point that she misses it when it's gone.
Let's have you read another passage from the book that deals specifically with the whole issue of what happens when you lose your cynicism.
Okay. David and Katie have gone to a dinner party with two friends of theirs, and the guy works in the media, on the bottom rung of the media ladder like David. And their usual dinner party conversation is just how rubbish everybody is apart from them, basically. I got sick of hearing why everybody was useless and ghastly and talentless and awful, and how they didn't deserve anything good that had happened to them, and they completely deserved anything bad that had happened to them. But this evening, I long for the old David. I miss him, like one might miss a scar or a wooden leg, something disfiguring but characteristic. You knew where you were with the old David, and I never felt any embarrassment, ever. Weary despair, sure. The occasional nasty taste in the mouth, certainly. Flashes of irritation, almost constantly, but never any embarrassment. I had become comfortable with his cynicism. And in any case, we're all cynical now, although it's only this evening that I recognise this properly. Cynicism is our shared common language, the Esperanto that actually caught on. And though I'm not fluent in it, I like too many things and I'm not envious of enough people, I know enough to get by. And in any case, it's not possible to avoid cynicism and the sneer completely. Any conversation about, say, the London Mayoral Contest or Demi Moore or Posh and Bex and Brooklyn, and you're obliged to be sour simply to prove that you're a fully functioning and reflective metropolitan person.
Great. Well, so they have this party and they can't get through the evening because there's really nothing to talk about. Once you've decided to be kind to everyone, I mean, what are you going to do after you comment on the new decor in the kitchen?
Yeah, it's the food and the redecoration, and then they dry up, basically.
So while there are very funny passages throughout this book, it seems with some of the message, your books are getting more serious.
I think probably this one's quite a serious book, although I do hope it has jokes in it. I couldn't write a book which didn't have jokes in it. But I suppose, yeah, the kinds of things it's about are quite serious, mm-hmm. Even if it's done in a hopefully entertaining way.
It's really entertaining, and all of your books, I said something earlier, they make you laugh out loud. There are points where you just stop reading and you laugh, or you call somebody up and read it to them over the phone, or you read to the person you're sitting next to on the couch. And I'm wondering, who are the writers who make you laugh?
P.G. Woodhouse made me laugh, mm-hmm. and still makes me laugh a lot. And one of the things I like about him is that there's no pretension that the books are really about anything at all. Mm-hmm. It's just like, my job is a comedy writer, and I'll write about any nonsense if it gets laughs, and it does. And I think, you know, that is a message of pure comedy, that, you know, there's that old Seinfeld thing, well, what's it about? And mm-hmm. you think, well, who cares? It's funny. It mm-hmm. has jokes every single minute, and it's the same for Woodhouse. Recently, I think parts of the Dave Eggers book are just fantastically funny, mm-hmm. And I think the person who taught me that you could be funny and serious and sad at the same time was Anne Tyler. There are passages in Accidental Tourist and Dinner at the Homesick Restaurant that I just thought were fantastically funny.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I know that you're a big fan of and also have included Roddy Doyle in the collection of short stories you edited. Did you read The Giggler Treatment, his children's book?
I haven't read it, no.
Wonderful book. Wonderful book. I mean, he's funny anyway, but yeah. This book, which is geared at children, is for everybody. One of the funniest things I've read.
Oh, okay. I'll check it out.
All year. Why don't you think that there are more funny books being written today? I mean, there seems to be a dearth, and I wonder why that is. I wonder if humor's underrated, or people just aren't that funny anymore, or those people aren't getting published. Why don't we have more books that make you laugh?
I think it's an interesting question, and the process that you have to go through to get a book published is quite difficult in a way, because books are judged by essentially very serious-minded people. And, you know, sometimes when I've finished a book and I know that it's got jokes in, I think, oh, God, you know, they're going to write about this in the Times Literary Supplement. And the kinds of people that tend to write in the Times Literary Supplement are not in themselves stand-up comedians.
you notice.
And I think it might deter people that, you know, that there is this general attitude that if you're going to write books that have any kind of ambition, then they shouldn't have jokes in them.
Did you, when you were growing up, did you read a lot of comic books? Was that part of what you read when you were younger?
Yeah, I used to read anything and everything. My favorite authors were the authors who'd written 19 other books that were exactly the same. I didn't care if the books were any good. I just liked looking at the list and the inside flap and thinking, oh, great, look at that. And I couldn't really really say that I had any interest in quality. So that and comics were pretty much all I read until I was in my teens, I guess.
And I would assume, have you read the Harry Potter books?
I've read the first two, and I'm saving the next.
And why? I mean, there are lots of reasons for this, and everybody has their own. But as a writer, writing in the UK and kind of familiar with the publishing and literary scene there. What do you think happened to create the sensation with those books? Why do you think they caught on the way they did?
Well, I think, like all books that have that kind of momentum, it starts from word of mouth, and you can just feel how solid those sales are. Things just start to burgeon out of control, and it's happened at home with Captain Crowley's Mandolin and Birdsong, Bridget Jones' Diary, I guess High Fidelity. You can just feel that everyone in the country's reading them, and she has such an extraordinary visual imagination, I think.
I have mixed feelings about the movie. We'll see what happens.
Well, it should be good. I mean, there are so many scenes that would lend themselves so naturally to movies.
We have to move into High Fidelity because I can see from the audience questions everybody wants to talk about High Fidelity. So let's start with, were you and Stephen Frears, the director of the movie, were really excoriated for the fact that this movie took place in Chicago rather than in London and in a particular neighborhood in London. Did you feel vindicated when the movie came out? It was really great and really funny and everybody loved it.
I never had any doubts that it would be good. Right from the moment I met the people who were going to be adapting it. They're very smart, they're very funny, they loved the book, they wanted to transfer as much of the spirit of the book into the screenplay as possible. And when I understood the level of care and attention the book was going to get, I didn't think that there would be a problem. Also, having toured the book here, nobody ever said to me, "Oh, I loved your book. It's what it's like to be English." You know, they always say, "I loved your book. My brother's like that." And, mm-hmm. and Englishness really never came up at all. So I didn't see it was a problem. It was, you know, it's a book about a record store and failed relationships. And America probably invented both of those.
Here's an audience question. As a single woman trying to understand the male species, I was drawn to High Fidelity when three mates told me they felt almost betrayed by your blisteringly accurate portrayal of their psyches and attitudes toward dating and women. Do you feel you have done male-female relationships a service or a disservice? And how do you answer the traitor accusation?
Well, I'm all for peace and harmony between the sexes, and if the more pathetic male ruses were exposed in the book, then at least it will make them think of some others. So, no, I plead absolutely not guilty. But I have to say, as the books had more of a life, more and more women have come up and said that they didn't think it was a guy book, that it was about them as much as it was about guys that they knew. And, you know, in the end, I guess Rob's just a guy who can't make a relationship work and doesn't really know what he wants from life. And I think that's a pretty gender-neutral state of mind in the end.
Which then again goes back to the issue of writing from a female perspective in this new book, that it wasn't such a major change.
No, I mean, that response encouraged me because I think there is so much invested now in telling us that the sexes are a long way apart and can't understand each other. I mean, you know, you go into a bookstore and there's millions of books on the subject and every single magazine cover says, you know, 10 ways you can understand your man and all that sort of thing. And I kind of bought into that for a while. And then one day, I mean, I live with a woman and I'm very rarely mystified by what she does on the grounds of her gender. Right. You know, and it just doesn't kind of come up in the normal run of things. It's, you know,
the Mars-Venus thing isn't big in the UK?
No, it's like, you know, I look at her and it's like, she's opening the fridge. What's she doing? She's she's getting some milk out. What does she want milk for? And, you know, that's our lives, really. And there isn't really such a gender issue there.
I have to imagine that after the publication of High Fidelity, people sent you top five lists a lot or asked you. And there is a top five question here. Do you want to take it or should we move on?
Well, we can have a go. But I have to say, since I wrote the book, if somebody asked me for my top five numbers, I could only come up with three. I just go blank all the time. But have a go.
Well, let's try Nick Hornby, 2001, July. What are your top five all-time desert island picks, parentheses, records, close parentheses.
As opposed to people. Or, yeah.
Peanut butters.
Well, I can never do an all-time top five apart from Let's Get It On, which closed the movie, which is always in there. And just certain songs mean different things at different times. So at the moment, songs I couldn't survive without are songs that are very, very loud and get me through book tour. So I'm listening to a band called Marah and a song called Reservation Girl. I listen to that all the time, and a Teenage Fan Club song called Everything Flows, and Kitty's Back by Bruce Springsteen. Things that pump me up, because it's knackering touring.
And when I get home, excruciating.
When I get home, it'll be five different songs.
So, moving into the New Yorker writing for a moment, you're writing about pop music for the New Yorker, which hardly has a demographic of young concert-going readers. I'd say we're talking about people mostly maybe 40s and up reading the New Yorker.
I guess so, but one forgets how the world has changed. I mean, anyone pretty much under 55 or 60 now has grown up in part at least listening to pop music. You know, Bob Dylan just turned 60. It's no longer a kind of high culture versus low culture, youth versus age thing, I don't think. It's just a part of all of our lives. And I've noticed at home there's a radio station called Radio 2, which used to play kind of, I don't know, do you know who Matt Munro is? And
I don't, but probably people here do.
Sort of croonery type people, and Sinatra and Tony Bennett. And just over the last few years, it's become the Stones and the Beatles. And, you know, this is what kind of middle-aged, middle-of-the-road, easy-listening music is mm-hmm. now, is, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. is rock music. So I think the demographic's fine, really.
Yeah, well, it's interesting because people who've grown up in the pop culture, and we don't wear grown-up clothes. I mean, there used to be a difference between grown-ups and people who weren't. And there's this whole big sort of melting now. So did Tina Brown hire you at the New Yorker, or did David Remnick?
No, David Remnick hired me. But yes, you're right. I think there is a lot of investment in keeping us young. If we're young, we spend more money. That's true.
Here's another music question from the audience. I loved your New Yorker piece on Steve Earle. Why do you think he's not achieved more widespread recognition?
I think partly because he doesn't compromise too readily. He's very interested in a lot of different issues. You know, he's spent a lot of time campaigning against the death penalty, and some of those records are quite kind of they are gritty, certainly, mm-hmm. and some of them are depressing. And he's going to be one of those guys who always has his own audience, but he's never going to get huge recognition. And I think probably his fans prefer it that way.
Have you seen his new book of short stories?
I have, yeah. And, you know, he's a really talented guy.
Yeah. They read like songs in a way.
Yeah, yeah. But he's had quite a life. So.
Yeah, yeah. How do you write about the way that something sounds?
Well, I think music's really tough. I mean, I tend to rely on placing things culturally and you know, little riffs on the kind of people who might listen to this music and comparing it to other music. But I think the very best music writers, they can nail down a sound. And I think the trouble with music writing is that you are prone to pretension if you do that. But I think it has to be done sometimes.
Who are the very best music writers?
Well, I think still the older guys. My favourites are Greil Marcus and Peter Guralnick. I mean, the work that they've done, even in the last few years, is just amazing, I think.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Back to High Fidelity for a moment, and the whole hue and cry in England about the venue change, and people say, "Well, I went to that pub, and that pub's not in the book, in the movie." One of the responses that you made in an interview that I found very interesting, I want to read to you and then ask you to expand on it. You say that there's scarcely any description in High Fidelity. Quote, "I find description difficult. I always hate descriptive passages as a reader and probably as a consequence loathe writing them." Talk about that a little bit.
I can never remember which way around it is. I have a really low boredom threshold. And for example, when I was a kid, I remember being given all these short stories and told that this is what short story writing was, and it always seemed to be kind of pages about trees, and then and then they ended. I just never, ever wanted to write about anything like that. But I think where the books are set, you know, they're set in cities, and you can be really sketchy about it. It's, you know, like an artist will do a couple of lines and people will immediately recognize what it's supposed to be. I think you can get by with that if you're writing for people who know what you're talking about. And to a certain extent, that's what I do.
It's interesting because I realized after reading that interview that I don't know what your characters look like, but I do know who they are.
Yeah, and I'm not interested at all in what they look like. I'd much prefer other people to make up their own minds about that.
Okay. Here's another question from the audience. Having dealt with serial relationships in High Fidelity in a way that made us all think exactly, how did you prepare for writing about issues dealt with in marriage, which with much of the same resonant success?
Oh, thank you. Well, I mean, these things that I write about, I think that not only have I experienced them, it's unavoidable, these experiences. If you're any kind of human being at all, you are going to have relationships, you are going to talk to guys and women, and your friends are going to be happy or unhappy and disappointed. And you don't need to prepare, I think, in the ways of a historical novelist. I just kind of use what I've got.
But marriage is difficult, and this book, it's interesting, because High Fidelity, we sort of have a 30-something grappling with the idea of commitment, and then about a boy, a really profound relationship develops between Nick and Marcus.
Will.
And then, pardon me?
Sorry, he's not called Nick. I just wanted to stop.
Why did I say that? Sorry. Will and Marcus. And here we have a real-life marriage that undergoes tremendous strain and difficulty, yet I don't think it's giving too much away to say that when all is said and done, they're working at it.
Yeah. I mean, Katie uses this rather gruesome and graphic metaphor about being stabbed. when you have a knife in your stomach, do you take it out or do you leave it in? And the medical advice is that you leave it in because it helps to staunch the bleeding. And that's the conclusion that she comes to, basically. She's got to leave the knife in.
An audience member says, apparently David in How to Be Good is defined as being the definition of aggrieved. I'd like to know where Nick feels he is on the aggrieved spectrum.
I really don't feel aggrieved anymore. I used to feel very kind of pent up. I think a lot of unpublished writers feel the same way, you know, that they're not getting anywhere and nobody's listening to them, and you do get frustrated. But I do have wonderful outlets now, and I have a pretty good life, so no aggravation or feeling aggrieved.
In terms of your characters and their progression, they've sort of gotten older and more mature as you've gone on. Do you think you could ever go back and write something about a 20-something person?
Yeah. I mean, I think that the next book I'm thinking of at the moment will have a variety of ages in it. It's, I think, a group of people who have something in common, but that they're all from different ages and backgrounds. And I've just read Charles Baxter's wonderful book, The Feast of Love. I don't know if you've seen that. And the line I loved in that is a young kind of surfing dude saying to a girl that he's trying to pick up, "You're pretty, but you're way underpierced." And I'm looking forward to getting into that stuff, because that's something. When you say that there's no age gap anymore, piercing, whoa.
Fun research. Do you ever worry that your books are, of course, filled with references to contemporary culture? Do you ever worry that that will date them?
Not in the slightest. And it started to irritate me, actually, that more writers don't use contemporary references, because it clicked that a reason a lot of them don't do it is because they do worry about posterity. And I think that's pretty kind of arrogant, really, that you're not worried about who's going to read you now, but you're worried about who's going to read you in 100 years' time. I want to take care of this side of things first, really.
And it sort of diffuses the whole impact.
Yeah,
and
I use popular culture and culture to place people. I think when there's an absence of all the old class nuances that we used to be able to have when we looked at people, I think popular culture is a better way of doing it now. You can work out who somebody is from what they watch and read and listen to.
Well, and there's an interesting point in How to Be Good where Katie realizes how much better she'll feel if she starts reading again, and if she buys some CDs that she likes, and if she just begins to surround herself with some of those things that make her happy, that are all part of the popular culture.
Yeah, in a way, it's kind of the flip side of High Fidelity and How to Be Good, where however much those characters valued the music and the stuff in their lives, that there was a suggestion, I suppose, that it was responsible for a certain amount of retardation. And and I think that Katie, she just doesn't have enough going on outside of her own head, and she learns to value things that Rob and Will, I suppose, have valued all the time.
Here's a question about your first book, Fever Pitch, which is written about your obsession with the Arsenal soccer team. By the way, do you still live right near the stadium?
Right near the stadium.
And do you still go regularly?
Yeah. Well, once you've made the huge commitment to move next to the stadium, actually, going regularly is the least of it.
Really. But you
it takes 2 minutes to do that bit.
But you have better seats now.
No, the seats haven't changed. There are five of us, and I don't think we could get five better seats together. So I'd rather, well, in fact, I have to stay where I am. Otherwise, I'd get all sorts of trouble for that.
Actually, going to those games was really your sort of seminal bonding experience with your father, because you're right at the beginning of High Fidelity that your parents were getting separated, and that was sort of your living room, going with him to those soccer games.
Yeah, it was somewhere to go at a time where we didn't really have anywhere to go. So it was a really big deal for me to spend an afternoon with my dad in a very kind of unpressured way. I think, you know, I say in Fever Pitch that children are not great conversationalists, and that thing of when you're only seeing your dad on a semi-regular basis, then somebody has to sit you down and say, how's your life going? And you're 11 years old. You know, you just look at your feet. Mm-hmm. You don't know what to say. But if you're at a soccer game, then there's something going on in front of you that you can talk about. I think, you know, kids especially need something dynamic, something that's actually happening to be able to comment on it.
Mm-hmm. An audience member wants to know, in a soccer game, each player needs to feel that the other players on his or her team will be where they're needed when the time comes.
There's a metaphor coming up.
Boy, he's sharp. Do you think your characters and we ourselves need to have that same sense of being part of a team to be happy?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's I think it's something that's come up really in all four books, the things about loyalty and wanting to know where you stand with other people. It's really important to me to have my team.
Nick Hornby, we're talking about High Fidelity, about a boy, and how to be good. You are so accurate, an audience member writes, about irresponsibility. Has something happened other than simply growing older to make you concerned about being responsible?
Well, I guess my own domestic situation. I am the father of a disabled child, and it does kind of change you, I think. There's a very thick line that's drawn in that, and when that happens, and it becomes pretty clear to you what your responsibilities are and what you have to do, even if it's hard. So it's one of the things that, possibly Rob if he doesn't experience that, I think there will always be a grey area in his life and lives of the people like that. But something really concrete that happens, I think, helps a lot to sort you out.
This is your son, Danny,
yeah,
who's 8 years old. Was he diagnosed as being autistic when he was a small baby?
Not until he was 3, in fact, which is pretty good going, because I think for most people it takes much longer to get a diagnosis, which is tough.
So were you wondering, did you perceive that things weren't the way they should be developmentally, or and so were you just waiting for a diagnosis?
Well, I think once we recognized that there were things wrong, it was pretty easy to work out mm-hmm. what it was. Mm-hmm. Danny's mum was involved in health, so she was, you know, she had a pretty good idea. So, no, that wasn't really a problem.
Speaking of Danny, you edited a collection of short stories called Speaking with the Angel and got many of the best short story writers around. I'm thinking Zadie Smith, Irvine Welch, Helen Fielding, Roddy Doyle, to write for this book. And all it's sort of a literary benefit where all of the money goes to Treehouse, which is a special school that you and your ex-wife co-founded for autistic children. And I was reading that this school uses an educational system that was imported from this country. Is the UK behind the States in terms of how to deal with autism?
Yeah, very much. I suspect it's partly a problem with our health service, which, you know, is a marvellous thing. And, you know, everybody gets free treatment regardless, and there's no health insurance. But I think in those circumstances, it probably means that there is less funding for more experimental techniques. And we're obliged, in that case, to wait and see what others are doing before we commit ourselves to one particular style. So I think in things like autism, the parents are probably way ahead of the authorities.
So what is the method? How do they teach the children? How do they work with the children?
Well, it's pretty interesting because one of the problems with autistic kids is that they don't copy, so they can't learn. And they don't make eye contact. They're not interested in what anyone else is doing. So at the very beginning, the very simple technique is to get the kids down, get the kids sat down, get them to look at you, and then sort of bang the table and hope that they do the same, and they've got to work out. And that's in itself a very long and difficult process to get them to imitate any kind of action. So it goes on from there and spreads out in all sorts of different directions. So that's a very crude summary of it, but it works, I think.
And is this school, does it have... Are more schools being developed throughout the country now in England, or is there just this one school that you and your...
No, there's a few schools that are using Treehouse as the model, so we're hoping that it kind of spreads all over the place.
I hate to suggest this, but it sounds like you're being good. It's how to be good, and you're taking care of your particular piece of it.
Well, you know, it's so easy. That book was so easy to do. And it was such fun to do. I basically asked some friends to write something, and they did. And it was kind of harder for them because they were giving up however long it took them to write a story. And, you know, there was a spell last summer where I was logging on in the morning, and there were like 3 stories there, one from Dave Eggers, one from Helen Fielding, one from Melissa Bank, that no one else in the world had seen. And...
you know, all original stories.
All original stories, wow. All written specially for the book. And, you know, that's not work or being good.
Right.
It's just fun.
So all of the proceeds go to the school?
Yeah, well, where the book's being published in other countries, including the US, I'm splitting the money with an equivalent local charity. So there's a school in New York that's getting half the US Speaking with the Angel money.
It's wonderful. And it's a wonderful book, too.
Yeah, well,
the introduction is really... compelling because it describes the day-to-day life of somebody dealing with an autistic child, but the stories, wow, they're terrific.
That was my main thing, was that I wanted a really good book. I didn't want people to worry about whether it was for charity or not. I just wanted them to look at the cover and think, I've got to have this, and we get the dollars from it. But I didn't want any kind of donation of any kind.
Let's move back to About a Boy, which we've sort of ignored a little bit in our conversation, and your novel Between High Fidelity and How to Be Good. And it's a very funny book, again, but it deals with depression, a really serious depression that a single mother, Fiona, in the book has. Did you do a lot of research into mental illness, or was that just kind of observation of people around you?
Yeah, I don't think that it's delved into deeply enough in that way for me to have read a lot of stuff. I mean, it's very much observed from the outside that she's unhappy and she doesn't know how to cope with it.
And she's made her son into something of an outcast because of her insistence that he listen to Joni Mitchell and Bob Dylan instead of the contemporary music that his friends are listening to and wears embarrassing mohair sweaters. He's kind of having a tough life in the book.
Yeah. They have this thing that they don't want to be sheep like everybody else. And I suppose one of the themes of the book is that being a sheep is actually pretty useful sometimes.
If you want to fit in.
Yeah.
So Fever Pitch was made into a movie. High Fidelity was made into a movie. About a Boy is it in production?
They just finished, actually, about 3 weeks ago, right before I came away. They wrapped, yeah.
And it's Robert De Niro's production company and Hugh Grant?
Hugh Grant is Will, and Toni Collette is Marcus's mum, I think, the wonderful Toni Collette, who was in Sixth Sense and Muriel's Wedding.
Uh-huh.
And I think, you know, she's just perfect casting. So I think it looks as though it might be good.
Did you spend time with the on the set and have a chance to...
I went down a couple of times. I just started touring with this book when they started filming, so I didn't go down as much as I wanted to or as often as I was invited.
Uh-huh.
They're really good guys, and again, like High Fidelity, they're very fond of the book and are very determined to try and do it justice.
Who wrote the screenplay?
It's these two young American guys called the Weitz brothers, and they work together. So they wrote the screenplay together, they direct together.
Mm-hmm. An audience member writes, in Mark Crispin's collection of criticism of television, Boxed In, he has an introduction called Hipness Unto Death. How have you seen irony take over people's lives in the last few decades?
Well, I just got sick of it. And I think it's one of the things that How to Be Good's about, really, that you can't fathom out what people mean anymore. Or rather, you can't fathom out what they feel about things anymore, because it is, you know, they hide behind it all the time. And I think the challenge for writers is to take on board irony and reject it at the same time, which is a tough thing to do. You know, that you want to try and be sincere, but you don't want to do it in some kind of dewy-eyed, sentimental, stodgy way. So we've got to try and be ironic without being ironic, or recognize irony without being ironic ourselves.
That's very tricky.
Yeah, it is tricky.
It's. Are you currently working on a screenplay with Emma Thompson? I read that somewhere.
Yeah, yeah.
Can you tell us about it?
Yeah, well, it was something I'd written a couple of drafts of a while ago and got stuck with it. And I was a bit worried that it was going to be made. way before it was ready, because I didn't think it was very good. And it was sent to her to direct, I think. Well, she hasn't done any directing, but someone had heard she was interested in directing. And I went to talk to her about it, and she was more interested in acting in it than directing it. But the ideas she had for it were just so kind of amazing and completely unjammed me and unstuck the narrative and everything. And I thought it was way beyond what an actress would normally offer to a screenplay. So I said to her, you know, I asked her if she wanted to start again with it, and we sit down in a room together. And that was what I was doing right before I came away. And it was just a fantastic experience, A, to write with someone, because I got fed up of sitting on my own in a room, and B, to work with someone as smart as she is. And, you know, when you go to the toilet and there's an Oscar sitting on the sitting on the cistern, you think you're in the right place.
That's where she keeps it?
Well, she's got two. Yeah, they're both in the toilet. Yeah.
You didn't write the screenplays for any of your...
I did for Fever Pitch.
Oh, you did for Fever
Pitch.
Yeah, I
did that myself, but not High Fidelity or About a Boy, no.
Just no desire to...
No. I mean, to me, there were High Fidelity and About a Boy. I think the process of adaptation is pretty horrible because it's actually about what you leave out rather than what you put in. I mean, however much we want to see movies based on our favourite books, the truth of the matter is they weren't ever intended to be movies, any of them. And a movie is 90 minutes and a book is 8 hours, roughly, or 10 hours, however long it would take you to read a book. So it's all, everyone always comes up and says, yeah, but they didn't have that scene with that in them. And
favourite scene.
Exactly, that's my favourite scene.
Right.
And everything everything you like has to be left out. You know, if you hit a riff in a book and you're enjoying it and it's working and it's funny or whatever, you can keep it going for as long as you right. feel you can justify it. In a screenplay, they're going to tell you to cut it after 2 pages because you just don't have the time for that kind of messing around. And I'd rather start with something that was meant to be a film in the first place, basically.
When you talk about hitting a riff, it reminds me of David Gates, who I know you widely admire and is a not widely read enough, to my mind, American novelist, contemporary novelist. And in his book Preston Falls, for example, when he hits that scene about the band rehearsal, he can go on and on and on for pages and pages, and it gets funnier and funnier, almost funnier the longer it gets, which is one example of something in a movie that just wouldn't be allowed to play that way.
I'm a great believer in that kind of humor, that overextending a joke can make it much funnier. You go through a part where it stops being funny, but then you can burst right through that and go out to the other side.
Well, the repetition makes it funny.
Yeah, exactly. There is a humor in repetition, and it's not something that you will see in movies very often.
It reminds me, though, I watched Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid with my son again the other night, and the who are those guys? You know, the more they say who are those guys, the funnier it gets. And you know, it's a rare filmmaker that knows how to...
They'd cut that now, I think.
They would. It would be half as long. What are some contemporary movies other than those of your work that you've seen lately that you just love?
Well, the film that really knocked me out was You Can Count on Me, just because I'd been seeing a lot of films that had too much money spent on them and were pretty violent, and the characters were cartoonish. I was on this panel last week on a CNN show, and we were talking about that new movie, is it Final Destiny, where they've animated humans, and there was a conversation about whether actors now had to watch out because they could animate people. And I had to think to myself, well, if they are taken over, they've kind of got themselves to blame. You know, they're routinely choosing parts in movies where you require maybe one or two facial expressions throughout the whole film, usually frozen horror for about 80 minutes of the film. And, you know, Angelina Jolie is playing a video character. And then in the same... breath, they're saying, oh, we don't like the way this is going. And you think, well, it doesn't add up. And what was great about You Can Count on Me was you could see that with a proper movie like that, it was never going to happen. There's so much range and so much expression. And it was kind of brutal in a way because of its honesty. And it's a long time since I've seen a movie that was brutal that didn't have a gun in it.
And I think it was confusing to people, too, in a way, why the brother wasn't more... one way or the other, and he wasn't. He was kind of good and kind of not.
Exactly, and wasn't that fantastic to see something where they didn't make your mind up for you?
Right, and where you had a single mother who kind of slept around but was an okay person.
A good person, yeah, exactly.
Astonishing.
Yeah, it was a really, really smart film, and I think it was kind of a way forward to a whole generation of filmmakers. I hope so, anyway.
Anything else?
Well, the other one was Memento, which I just thought was dazzling, and it gave me a headache. But
did you see it more than once?
I haven't. I will see it on video, definitely, because I would like to work a few things out at least. But it's one of those great things that where you can love something and at the same time recognize that you could never do it in a million years. I mean, I just would not have had the patience or anything to write that movie. And it is fantastic to see something so far outside your own taste and ability and enjoy it so much.
Here's another audience question. A writer's life is solitary. I think I can guess the answer to this. How do you like the marketing, public reading, and other non-writing activities of the modern writer's life?
Well, I do. I like it. I mean, I don't like the traveling, and I don't like being away from home particularly. But I think if you've had 2 years in a room, you're just about getting to the stage where you want to talk to some people. And you know, I get excited about having finished a new book and... You know, it's all this sort of virgin territory to read out loud and talk about, and then you do it for too long, and you want to get back in the room again. So it works out okay.
A last audience question: do you feel that prospective mates are afraid of you because they might appear in future work?
That's what I tell myself. Yeah. No, they're just afraid. They're just afraid.
Well, Nick Hornby, of course, is here talking about How to Be Good, his latest novel. We've also talked a little bit about Fever Pitch and about a boy. And before we leave again, remind us about your new book that you're working on and when we can look forward to it.
Oh, the book is way, way, way away. I'll probably start it next year when the paperback of this one's out, because it's very hard if you haven't got a huge... tranche of time to sit down and write a novel. That's why screenplays work out pretty well, because they're quite short and you can get drafts done quite quickly, and then you have to do another draft and another draft and another draft. But it's a different process from writing a novel, so I need to think about it a lot longer yet.
Great. Well, thank you so much for being with us today at the Commonwealth Club's Good Lit program. If people are interested in the new Young Professional program at the Commonwealth Club, please see us online at www.commonwealthclub.org. Nick Hornby, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Good afternoon.